Last Transport, Part 3. The other male member of Zod's Alpha Team, besides the loathsome Non, who didn't really count, touched down on the west side of Puckett's Landing, looked around to get his bearings, then walked up the street until he arrived in front of one of the district's many converted warehouses. This particular one's facade, though little different from the others, was famous to TV viewers all over the galaxy. Above the door, it bore a welded metal sign reading M5 Industries. He knew he would have to move carefully. Adam Venn was a buffoon, but his companions included two Jedi Knights, and they were known to be treacherous. If he just bulled his way in and started wrecking things, as Zod had instructed, who knew what might happen? No, this was a situation to be handled with will, not muscle. At the first insistent knock on the door, a figure in a hazardous materials suit faced with silvery foil swung it open. "Why, if it isn't Devnah," said the hazmat suit in the muffled voice of Adam Savage. "A lieutenant now? Listen, if this is about those parking tickets—" "Save your attempts at wit, Adam Venn," Devnah snapped. "I'm here to see if you are harboring a fugitive." Adam stepped back and made a "please enter" gesture. "By all means, have a look around." The shop was its usual cluttered self. Despite owner Jamie Heineman's occasional efforts to get things cleaned up and organized, it could never really keep ahead of the curve of entropy, and Devnah would not have cared to guess what most of the in-progress projects scattered around were, especially the one that appeared to involve a scale model of a Sarlacc. Baseball-sized camera drones shuttled here and there in an idle patrol pattern. Besides Adam, Devnah could see three people. Heineman, unmistakable with his white shirt, black beret, and walrus mustache. Carrie Byron, a red-headed girl with a bowler hat, threadbare jeans, and an I-do-all-my-own-stunts t-shirt. And a dark-haired Bajoran woman in a grease-smudged welder's apron and heavy gloves, who had just been in the process of welding part of some kind of metal frame together. She must have been Heineman's Jedi Padawan, but Devnah couldn't remember her name. No matter. "Why are you wearing that ridiculous getup?" Devnah asked Adam as he strode into the shop. Adam shut the door behind him and then strolled unhurriedly after him. "We've been handling some hazardous materials today," he said. Devnah gave him a dark look, considered cautioning him again about his attempts at wit, then ignored him and turned to Heineman. "Keep your hands where I can see them, Jedi," he said sternly. "I'll have no tricks out of you." Jamie nodded equably, holding his hands open at his sides. "I'm not looking for any trouble," he said. "What is it you're looking for, exactly?" "I have reason to suspect that you may be harboring the fugitive Kara Zor-El," he said. "I'm here to search your premises."
"Go ahead," Jamie said.
"Yeah, we've got nothing to hide," Carrie added.
Devnah gave her a sharp look. "Everyone has something to hide," he said coldly.
"Obviously you didn't see the Spaceliner toilet episode," Jamie's Padawan Bastila said under her breath, causing Carrie to choke down a burst of laughter.
Devnah made a grumbling noise, then ignored them as well, and scanned the building with his X-ray vision. He found a few more people at work in other rooms, and a number of items whose functions he could not even begin to grasp, but nothing pointed to the presence of the fugitive, except...
"What's in there?" he demanded, pointing to a large metal box sitting at the far end of the room.
"It's lined with lead. I thought you said you had nothing to hide," he added with a barbed look at Carrie.
"Nothing you'd be interested in," Jamie said.
Devnah's eyes narrowed triumphantly.
"The penalties for harboring a fugitive from Neo-Kryptonian justice are quite severe, Earthman," he said. "I look forward to seeing them exacted in your case."
He rounded on Adam.
"And especially in yours, Adam Venn," he added. Then he turned and strode briskly to the metal box. What a clumsy attempt, he thought to himself. He would have expected better from someone so reputedly clever as Heineman. He was already savoring his promotion to captain when he reached for the lid of the box.
"Listen, you really shouldn't do that," Heineman cautioned him.
"Yeah, Dev, for Rao's sake, don't open that."
Adam added, coming up behind him and reaching as if to catch his shoulder. The inflection in his voice was oddly, even exaggeratedly flat, as though he was reciting the line by rote, but Devna paid no attention. "Don't presume to give me instructions," he growled. Then he shoved Adam away, grabbed the lid, and wrenched it off, to reveal a chunk of glowing green crystal about the size of a basketball. "Ah!" he screamed as the kryptonite's radiation sliced into his nerve endings like a billion shards of glass. His body felt like it was on fire as his strength deserted him. He staggered back, which helped a little, but the piece was so big. "Did Jamie mention that he has a license to handle kryptonite?" Adam said helpfully from within his protective suit. "You wouldn't believe the paperwork involved," Jamie said. Devna turned to Adam and seized him somewhat less than convincingly by the front of his suit. "That's against Ares." Adam shrugged. "Hey, we told you not to open it," he said, then punched the Zodite out, being very careful not to take his weakened head off in the process. "Ow," he said, shaking his gloved hand. "Adam, you wuss," Carrie said jokingly as she tonged up the kryptonite and put it back in its rated containment unit. Adam pulled off his hazmat suit's hood and said, "Hey, kryptonite exposure reduces invulnerability immediately. It doesn't negate it immediately." "So what do you think?" Jamie asked, hunkering down to slap a transporter tag on Devna's back. "Kryptonian superintelligence?" "Busted," Carrie said without hesitation. "Absolutely busted," Bastila agreed. "I could have told you that," Adam said wryly. Feora Darval raked the front of a block of brownstones with her heat vision, laughing at the terror of the humans and other aliens as they ran for cover. One of Zod's youngest but most ardent followers, she was as firm a believer in Kryptonian supremacy as any there was, and no one among Zod's loyalists was more disgusted by the weakness of New Krypton's historical and present leaders as she. How dare the El Brothers kowtow to the fearful humans and agree that the Kryptonian people should be resettled, imprisoned, on another Red Sun world? Well, mighty Zod would take care of that once he was the autocrat of all the Kryptonians. In the meantime, Feora didn't really understand what the big deal was about the girl. An El or not, she was only a child, militarily and politically inconsequential. But if Zod wanted her dead, then Zod would get her that way. Zod's every whim was Feora's command, for he was the last hope of the Kryptonian people's dignity. "You're not even worth killing," she remarked to an unconscious NAPD riot cop, tossing his limp body over her shoulder to crash down on the roof of a parked car. "Is there no one in this miserable city who can challenge me?" There was a sudden gust of wind, and abruptly a tall, chestnut-haired woman in an odd white and gold costume stood before her. "Try me," Mary Marvel said, then slugged Feora as hard as she could. The blow, delivered with the full strength of Hercules, sent the Kryptonian bouncing down the street like a mannequin thrown from a speeding truck. She plowed into the facade of a bank, sending twisted metal from the security grating flying, then hauled herself out, wiped at her chin, and was astonished to discover blood. The raven-haired Zodite snarled furiously and hurled herself out of the wreckage, speeding down the street at an altitude of 3 feet. But when she got to where her attacker had been standing, Mary wasn't there, having taken to the air herself. Feora pursued her assailant through the metal canyons of downtown New Avalon for several minutes, finally intercepting her near the entire state building. They clashed and reclashed several times before Feora managed to grab hold of Mary and carry her straight down. The two streaked into the street in front of the entire state's main lobby entrance, cratering the asphalt and breaking a water main. The crater filled rapidly with water, obscuring the two struggling figures from sight. A few moments later, as horrified onlookers watched, Mary Marvel exploded up out of the impromptu pond like a Polaris missile, arced up and over an abandoned bus, and crashed into the street, carving an impact furrow like a meteor for half a block before she came to rest against her standing bow wave of shattered asphalt and churned up dirt. Feora, a bit bruised and bloodied, but still in fine form, rose from the pond in a more controlled fashion a moment later, water streaming from her hair and her torn, battered uniform. She hovered to the edge of the pond, conscious of the effort her air of unhurried gravity was having on the cowering primitives, then touched down and walked deliberately to her opponent. Grabbing a handful of Mary's tunic, she hauled the semi-conscious woman upright, cocked her fist for the death blow, and said tauntingly, "Nothing to say, human?" "Why do they always give me such wonderful openings?" Mary wondered. Then she opened her eyes and said in a calm voice, "Shazam." It was a great trick, one that Bill had figured out almost by accident and then taught to his sister. Speaking the wizard's name summoned the magic lightning that changed the Batson siblings from their normal selves into the mighty avatars of Shazam. But Bill had discovered that it was possible to dodge that lightning with the speed of Mercury, and if it struck anyone other than a Batson, the result was devastating. The ruse worked perfectly. All Mary had to do was jerk backward a few inches. Feora's grip on her tunic did the rest, and then the Zodite took the lightning stroke square in the back. Kryptonians, Mary knew, were vulnerable to magic. Not as vulnerable as ordinary humans, to be sure, but it could hurt them considerably more than normal firepower. She had first-hand confirmation of this as the power of Shazam smote Feora. The Zodite screamed and almost crumpled, knocked momentarily senseless by the jolt of mystic energy. Mary broke Feora's grip on her tunic, took her own grip on the Zodite's uniform jacket, and drove the point home. Shazam! Boom! Shazam! Boom! Shazam! Boom! When the dazzled onlookers' vision cleared, they saw Mary Marvel standing tall in the middle of the street, surrounded by bullseyes of scorched and melted asphalt, holding a limp Feora by the collar. Smoke rose from the Zodite's smoldering uniform and frazzled hair. Her head lolled, eyes rolled back in her head. Mary gave her a little shake to make sure she wasn't playing possum, as she herself had done, then dropped her to the ground. All around, bystanders emerged slowly from cover, looking stunned, half-deafened by the magic thunder. Hesitantly at first, then more lustily, they began to applaud. Mary Marvel blushed becomingly, gave them a wave, and then picked up her unconscious opponent and headed out to drop her off at Terminal Island. It was Zira Chozar who thought of Titan's Tower first. She was sweeping the south shore from the air, alternately raking the streets with heat, telescopic, and X-ray vision, when the distinctive T-shaped tower on its island at the north end of the bay caught her attention out of the corner of her eye. "They're about the same age as the fugitive," she thought, and smiled. Small and blonde, she had been the logical choice to impersonate Kara for the attack on the embassy. It would be a sweet piece of symmetry if she was also the one who brought Kara in. She flew out over the harbor and turned north, bearing directly for the tower, but suddenly another flyer was alongside, pacing her with a roar of combustive propulsion. He was a lanky young human in his early 20s, dressed in a black leather jacket and a black and yellow tunic with an X pattern. For a moment, Zira thought he was flying with a primitive rocket device, until she realized that no such equipment was in evidence. His lower body seemed to be the rocket. It was obscured entirely by smoke and seething energy, and above the waist he seemed to be suffused with a strange, smoky yellow glow. "I don't suppose," Sam Cannonball Guthrie drawled, "you'd care to save us both a peck of trouble and surrender." Zira laughed. "Surrender? To you?" Sam flipped back one side of his jacket to reveal the badge affixed to the inside. "That was the general idea," he allowed. "I have a better idea," Zira replied. "I think it'll be simpler still if I just kill you." So saying, she jinked left, crowding his airspace, and lashed out with a punch that should have reduced his head to a fine pink mist, even allowing for the relative lack of leverage. Her fist smacked into what she had taken for simple radiance, the nearly impenetrable energy field that always surrounded him in flight. The field absorbed the impact and converted it into reserve energy, boosting Cannonball's endurance. Zira snarled and lunged again, but Sam just grinned and put on some more speed, darting out in front of her. That really got her blood boiling. No mere human, even one possessed of such a strange ability as this, was going to get the better of a trained Neo-Kryptonian shock trooper in the air. There had been a time when Cannonball truly lived up to his nickname, though he could achieve ballistic flight easily enough. As a young man, he had almost no control over his flight path, and his aerial endurance was measured in seconds. That was years of training and hard-won experience ago, though, back when he hadn't truly understood the nature of his mutant power. Now he could go for hours, and, as he proceeded to demonstrate by leading Zira a dizzying race all over the skies of New Avalon, he'd pretty well licked that steering problem. Seemingly immune to inertia, he could corner like a light cycle, changing course with the speed of thought. Even Zira couldn't quite keep up with him in the twisting canyons of the city. She tagged him a few times with her heat vision, but that had no visible effect either, and every bit of energy she dumped into his blasting field was a bit he didn't have to come up with himself. When he roared low out of FDR Boulevard and out over Lake Daniels again, though, Sam was through demonstrating his maneuvering prowess. What had been a three-dimensional rally became a drag race as he poured on all the speed he could muster. A towering rooster tail of spray and steam exploded up from the surface of the water in his wake. When he punched through the sound barrier 2 miles out, he started actually pulling away from his own surface wake, diamond shock patterns forming in his blasting trail. Zira gritted her teeth and gave chase, determined to catch him, overtake him, get hold of him, and force him down. Whatever that force field of his might be, she was confident that if she could get a grip on him, she could break through it eventually and crush the meat and bone within. Sam looked up to where the green hills of a small island were coming up fast. Then he glanced down and back and saw that Zira was slowly catching up, trying to come up from below him. Perfect. He kicked in his last reserves of speed, accelerating to nearly 3 times the speed of sound. Unused to pulling such heavy speed in an atmosphere, Zira faltered for a moment, allowing him to open a 2-mile lead, and then caught herself and started gaining again. Ahead, on the fast-growing island, a white speck appeared at the top of the tallest hill. Baring his teeth in an exultant grin, Cannonball adjusted his course slightly. Roy Lincoln, alias the Human Bomb, dropped to one knee, braced himself, and balled both bared fists together, concentrating with all his might. A nimbus of orange-black energy started roiling around his hands, obscuring them entirely from sight. Cannonball came streaking in straight at him, then ticked up at the last minute and barreled past mere feet overhead, his shockwave nearly bowling the white-suited figure over. Teeth gritted with effort under his containment suit's helmet, the Human Bomb rode it out, timed the approach of Cannonball's pursuer, and then roared, "Smile, you space fascist!" Lunging up from his crouch, the Human Bomb brought his joined fists swinging up and around together, like a man performing an Olympic hammer throw. By the time Zira realized that there was someone in her pursuit path, the blow connected with the full force of the Human Bomb's explosive might behind it. Kaboom! Cannonball skidded out of his headlong dash, pulled a series of quick 90-degree turns to shed excess speed, then started heading back at a more prudent pace. A smallish mushroom cloud of orange fire and black smoke was rising from the crest of the ridge on Charles Island. Cannonball punched through the blast wave, then whipped a pair of electro-binoculars from inside his jacket and scanned the skies. There she was, a black speck hurtling skyward, still heading up, apparently out of control. Sam vectored her to intercept, and caught up with Zira just as she reached apogee. The Zodite was completely limp. Her uniform jacket was almost entirely blown away, and a livid red-black bruise burn showed on the side of her face. It looked like a nasty injury, but Sam knew it was certainly no worse than she had intended to do to him. He cut his blasting field so he could grab her by the collar, then kicked it in again and made for the island. This was a risky move. If she came to, or if she was faking in the first place, Zira would easily be able to injure him, but if he let her fall into the lake in her present condition, she might actually manage to drown before he could fish her out, and that would never do. She reminded Sam a little bit of his kid sister, except, of course, that Paige would never have thrown a bus into an embassy just for the hell of it. He landed on the beach, tagged his unconscious cargo, and called for transport. Then he climbed up the blackened, denuded edge of the island's new crater in search of his partner. The Human Bomb lay sprawled on his back in the center of the crater, where the ridgeline had once been.
His containment suit was covered in streaks of soot, and the sleeves ended in tatters just below his elbows, but his arms looked undamaged. Little spits and crackles came from the faint orange-black glow of his bare skin as his mostly depleted powers touched off tiny particles of dust.
Roy? You okay?
The human bomb lay unresponsive for a moment, then groaned and sat up, resting his elbows on his knees.
Wouldn't want to try that again.
Did we get her?
Yeah, we got her, Cannonball said, plopping down next to the human bomb. Come on, let's get you in for repairs before your powers build back up.
Looking back on the day, Robin would later conclude that his greatest achievement was not getting anybody killed. When the fight began, there was no guarantee of that. The Titans found themselves with not one but two Neo-Kryptonians to deal with, a woman in a uniform and a hulking, disheveled, beetle-browed brute of a man dressed in what looked like a prison uniform. "I'm only going to give you one chance, children," the woman declared as she touched down on the south shore of Perez Island. "Surrender the girl and we'll let you live."
"Ursa," Robin said grimly. "I should have known. Who's your friend?"
Ursa laughed lightly. "Non is no one's friend, boy wonder. Officially, he doesn't even exist." Her cruel face became hard as she added, "Not that that will stop him from killing you. Be smart for once in your life. Give us Kara Zor-El. You can't beat us."
"We'll see."
Robin drew a birdarang from behind his back and thumbed its wings open with a singing metallic sound.
"Let's go."
He hurled the birdarang. With a contemptuous snort, Ursa intercepted it with her heat vision, precisely as he had hoped she would. The heat flashed the charge of liquid pseudo-kryptonite inside the weapon to steam, causing a violent explosion of green gas that engulfed both Zodites.
"What the—"
Ursa cried. A wave of sickness washed over her as she breathed in the vaporized substance. Behind her, Non grabbed at his throat, eyes bulging. "That won't be enough to put them down," Robin thought, "but it may give us a fighting chance." Ursa recovered her wits first. She dispelled the cloud with a wave, but since she and Non had both caught and inhaled a faceful of the gas, the damage was mostly done. She felt slightly woozy, off balance, and she could tell that her speed and power were a bit off. But only a bit. Her heat vision lanced out again, carving a glowing furrow across the rock where Robin had been standing.
"Your gambit failed, boy," she crowed.
"It was only an opening move," Robin replied. "Stargirl, Starfire, go!" Two slim figures appeared from behind Robin's ex-perch. One, tall and orange-skinned, streaked around from the left in full flight and slammed fists first into Non's chest, bowling the monstrous convict over backward. The other, shorter and blonde, clad in blue and red with a big white star on her chest, vaulted the rock from the right and charged toward Ursa. For a second, the female Zodite thought this was her target, dressed up in an outlandish costume like her ridiculous friends. Then she remembered that Stargirl was one of the newer members of the Titans, the ones on whom the NKDEA didn't have much intel data yet. She derived her powers from technology, something to do with stellar energy manipulation, based on the same principles as the late Red Lensman's cosmic rod? Well, that shouldn't be much of a challenge. Stargirl ducked a third heat vision blast, rolled out of the follow-through, and socked Ursa in the gut. To Ursa's distinct surprise, the blow hurt. It didn't drive the wind from her, but it stung and drove her back. At first she thought that perhaps the kryptonite-like gas, another weapon for the department's forensics people to analyze when this was all over, had weakened her more than she initially thought. But when she glanced down at herself, she saw that the impact site on the front of her uniform tunic was actually singed slightly. Stargirl capitalized on this distraction, following up her gut punch with an uppercut that staggered Ursa a little. Recovering her balance, Ursa growled angrily and launched a punch of her own. The blow knocked Stargirl flying, but, Ursa was angrily astonished to discover, it hurt to deliver, too.
Stargirl tumbled through her landing, came up on one knee, and wiped a trace of blood from the corner of her mouth with one gloved hand, grinning nastily at her opponent as Ursa regarded her scorched knuckles with visible shock. "You do realize," Stargirl said in a mocking tone, "that a red sun is really a kind of star?" Ursa blinked, then looked at her again with more discerning eyes. Now she could make out a flickering glow, a corona of energy, surrounding the girl. Almost invisible in the bright afternoon sunlight, it was nonetheless distinct now that Ursa was looking for it. It seemed to emanate from the belt Stargirl wore, and it was tuned to closely resemble the output of New Krypton's sun. Ursa's lip curled. "I'll take that toy and smash you with it," she snarled. Meanwhile, Nan was trying to come to grips with the Crown Princess of Tamaran, a young woman whose power approached that of his own mighty race. After the first blow, their combat had become a fast-paced dance. Stargirl knew she had no chance of matching a monstrous specimen like Nan blow for blow, so she was counting on her superior speed and agility to carry the day. That, and her ability to channel the mysterious form of energy known as Getter Rays, into powerful starbolts. Silent and malevolent, Nan tried several times to connect with his massive fists, but when that didn't work, he showed that he wasn't, perhaps, as mindless as he seemed. He shifted tactics, feinting and then anticipating Starfire's dodge. His hand flashed out and caught her by the ankle. Starfire gave a startled cry as he swung her overhead and smashed her into a boulder, crushing it to gravel. He leaned down, thinking to pick her crumpled form up and smash it down again. She rolled onto her back, opened eyes glowing so brightly with green energy that the light rendered her irises and pupils invisible, and thrust a hand forward. A brilliant green bolt shot from her palm, smacking Nan square in the face. He reared back, grabbing at his face as smoke rose between his fingers. Starfire launched herself, following the blast up with a ground-shaking 1-2 punch combo that sent her hulking opponent reeling backward. Nan regained his balance and lowered his hands, revealing an angry red scorch on his face. Getter rays were not the same thing as kryptonite radiation, but they were cousins, close enough that Starfire's starbolts could make some headway against a Kryptonian, if not with the full effect they would have on another. It was just such a family resemblance that had started IPO researchers, among the galaxy's foremost investigators into Getter rays, down the path that had led to pseudo-kryptonite's invention. The injury seemed to deepen the monstrous Neo-Kryptonian's thoughtless fury further. With new speed and strength, he seized first one, then the other, of Starfire's wrists and pulled them inexorably outward, as if seeking to tear her arms from their sockets. Up in the Titan's tower control room, Kara Zor-El paced and chafed. "We shouldn't be standing around up here," she said to Cyborg. "We should go down there and help them." Cyborg shook his head. "Robin said for you to stay here, and for me to stay with you in case they get through," he said. "I don't like sitting this fight out either, but he's in charge." "You just do whatever he says?" Kara shot back. "Yeah," Cyborg replied, not rising to the bait. "Look, those two would take you apart. They're full-grown Kryptonians with military training, and the big one looks like a stone killer. You wouldn't last a minute. Corey and Courtney are professionals. They can handle it." Kara balled her fists. "I could make you let me go." Cyborg looked her up and down, then nodded. "Yeah, I bet you could," he said. "If you really want to go, I won't stop you. I'm just asking you. Trust me. Trust Robin. He knows what he's doing." "He doesn't even have any powers." "I know. That's what makes him great," Cyborg said. Kara blinked, taking that in. Below, Ursa held Stargirl up by the neck with one hand and strained to push her other hand through the Titan's protective force field and seize her cosmic converter belt, ignoring the considerable pain both operations were causing. As she struggled to get some leverage for a counterattack, Stargirl could feel the belt's center unit starting to heat up as Ursa's relentless assault overloaded its coils. If she didn't do something to break free soon, Ursa's wrath would be the least of her worries. Robin hurled another birdarang, this one a conventional explosive. He was taking a chance, but it was the kind of chance he was good at, and it paid off. The weapon struck Ursa's wrist, just outside Stargirl's force field, and went off. Ursa's invulnerability was just compromised enough by her prolonged contact with Stargirl's red sun field that she felt the blast. It did her no real harm, but the surprise of feeling it at all made her release her grip. Stargirl rolled with the fall, kicked out, and put some distance between herself and the maddened Zodite. Ursa turned and blasted at Robin, who barely got out of the path of her heat vision in time to avoid being barbecued. "Not good," he said. "The gas is wearing off. They're starting to get their speed back." Stargirl lunged in and got Ursa's attention back with a kick to the gut. "Where the hell is Flash?" she asked. As if summoned, a scarlet blur zoomed across from the mainland and stopped next to Robin. "Right here," the Flash declared. Then, angling a thumb back over his shoulder, he added, "And I brought some help." A figure dressed in a blue parka and snow goggles, incongruous on this bright, sunny spring afternoon, stood at the top of a beachside crag, brandishing a pair of silver pistols. "Woohoo!" he cried, then started blasting away, his weapons slashing beams of white energy at both Neo-Kryptonians. "Eat freeze-ray, super-Nazis!" Next to him, a slimmer figure in a white suit not entirely unlike the human bombs, unleashed a stream of rippling flame from a bulky orange pistol, washing it over Ursa as she staggered back from a roundhouse blow from Stargirl. Robin looked askance at the Flash. "You brought Captain Cold and Heatwave?" The Flash shrugged. "Hey, we need all help we can get." One of Captain Cold's freeze rays struck Nan full in the back. With the ambient temperature around him reduced to near absolute zero for a moment, he stiffened, condensation freezing all over his body. Starfire took advantage of the momentary respite, closed her eyes, and gathered her concentration. Nan shrugged off the freezing effect with relative ease and started to pull on Starfire's arms again, his hands like a pair of steel vices on her wrists. She opened her eyes, blazing once again with green energy. A solid getter beam blasted from them and struck Nan in the chest, incinerating the top of his jumpsuit and sending him hurtling back amid a spray of ice chips and green-tinted steam. Starfire helped him along by kicking herself free from his slackening hands, then hovered in place with residual energy crackling around her eyes. "I hope that hurt," she said, her usual sunniness erased by the wrath of the princess. Ursa had had about enough of this. The nauseating, weakening effects of that green gas were wearing off now, and she could feel her full speed and power returning. The force field surrounding Stargirl boosted her speed and strength as well, but with Ursa's full power returning, the girl would be no match for her. Ursa dodged a flying kick and moved to snatch Stargirl from the air by the neck. But something was wrong. She could feel herself slowing down again. Even more so, in fact. The sick feeling didn't come back, nor the sensation of weakness, but it was like being buried in tar. Her movements came so slowly, barely faster than those of a normal human. What could be causing such an effect? She turned and saw the Flash still standing next to Robin. His arms were folded across his chest, and he seemed to be completely inactive, an odd state of affairs indeed for him. But a closer look revealed that his eyes were obscured by seething yellow light. She leveled a blast of heat vision at him, but he moved out of the way so quickly he almost seemed to have teleported. Ursa realized her perceptions were slowed as well. She had no idea how he was doing it, but somehow the Flash was stealing her super speed. How was that even possible? No matter. She still had her martial training and her strength. Even with human reaction time, she could defeat one child with a clever toy. Nan, too, redoubled his efforts, enraged beyond even his normal limits by the agonizing burns the Tamaranian's blast had inflicted on his chest. He raced in at the highest flying speed he could muster and slammed one of his granite block fists into her midsection. She crumpled around the blow. He followed it up with a sock to the jaw that put her entirely out for a moment. When she came to, she was face down on the ground, and the silent monster had one of her wrists in each hand again, and a foot in the middle of her back. The position was incredibly painful, and put him out of all her useful firing arts. Robin saw what was happening, and peppered Non with blast discs and explosive birdarangs, but the bestial Zoddite was totally focused on his task and ignored the blows altogether. Not even concentrated fire from Captain Cold and Heatwave could distract him. Then something did. From somewhere above him he heard a roaring, howling sound. It was getting louder, and louder, and louder. Finally, it penetrated his consciousness to the point where he paused for a moment in his efforts to dismember Starfire, and looked up. He had just enough time to register the oncoming aircraft, a sleek, black, bat-winged jet, before it plowed into his upper body. Gasping with pain as his hold on her arm suddenly tautened almost to the breaking point and as suddenly released, Starfire threw herself forward. The Batjet's hurtling mass bore Non down on his back and shoved him deep into the ground before piling in on top of him and exploding. High above, having locked her jet into its dive and bailed out, Batgirl free fell in a graceful arc toward a painful date with Lake Daniels. "A little help here?" she said calmly into her mask's built-in comlink. Stargirl ducked a nearly supersonic punch from Ursa, hop-kicked the Neo-Kryptonian over backward, then said, "I'm on it," reached the flap holster strapped to her right thigh, and drew her gravity rod. As she switched it online, the device, a metal rod about a foot long, topped with a bullet-shaped cap sporting three Art Deco cooling fins, glowed with a brilliant yellow light and carried her into the air. She streaked aloft, stretched out a hand, and snagged the falling Batgirl by a fistful of her cloak. With a laugh, Ursa launched herself to intercept, thinking to catch Stargirl off guard. In this, she essentially succeeded, but she didn't catch Batgirl off guard. Without hesitation, the black-clad girl reached up and thumbed an interlock that released her cloak. Stargirl was, to put it mildly, surprised to see her teammate suddenly plummet free again, leaving her holding nothing but a black cloak. Then she saw what had caused Batgirl to cut and run. Reacting instinctively, she let go of the cloak, leveled the gravity rod, and fired her own kind of starbolt, hitting Ursa square in the chest. It had no notable effect. Stargirl hadn't had time to retune both of her weapons for the red solar spectrum. The gravity rod was still on its default yellow-white setting. "Oh, crap," Stargirl had time to say before Ursa hit her, knocking the wind out of her and sending the gravity rod spinning out of her hand. Now there were two falling titans. No problem. When she cut herself loose, Batgirl employed a skydiving technique she'd learned from Batman to aim herself toward Titan's tower. From the altitude at which she'd resumed her fall on this vector, she would come in under one of the crossbars and hit the ground right about at its base, which wouldn't be optimal since she'd be doing terminal velocity when she got there. She hoped Robin realized what she was doing, and then, with her uncanny ability to read body language and predict actions from it, saw that he did. Robin saw her shaping her fall, mapped it in his head, then whirled and fired his jumpline launcher into the air. The grapple shot upward and chunked into the underside of the tower crossbar. An instant later, Batgirl flew past the cable, darted out one hand, and snagged hold of it. Her momentum immediately whipped her upward, wrenching her shoulder painfully. She let out a strangled grunt and hung on, twisting her body so that she could get her other hand on the line as well. Layers of Duraflex burned away as she slid down the cable. Robin braced himself and hung on with both hands. The initial shock of her weight hitting the cable had almost jerked him off his feet. As she swung around again, Batgirl got a foot out and dug the edge of her boot sole into the taut cable, then got her other foot underneath her so she was sort of surfing down the line. She could feel the thin cable biting grooves into both steel-reinforced boot soles, but now she was definitely slowing down. Her eyes flicked skyward in time to see Ursa knock the gravity rod from Stargirl's hand. Balanced now in a controlled slide, she took one hand off the cable and moved it to her utility belt. 1 second later, she got to the end of the line. Arching her back, she swung herself sideways and into a tumble so as not to plow into Robin. By now, she was going no faster than if she'd jumped from a moving subway train, something she did with slightly depressing regularity. As she rolled through the fall, she fired her own jumpline launcher into the sky. Weighted by the grapple at the end, her line shot out and wrapped around Stargirl's ankle, fizzing and sparking against her force field. Realizing what Batgirl was trying to do, Stargirl cut the field, letting the cable tighten around her sturdy boot. Batgirl thumbed the retractor button, grabbed the launcher with both hands, and put her back into it. Though small, her body was perfectly conditioned, kept that way through a combination of a fastidious workout routine, a strenuous occupation, and a fortunate draw from the genetic deck. The deceptive power in her long, smooth muscles had given more than one opponent cause for regret. Now, as she hauled on the line and translated Stargirl's vertical fall to horizontal flight, someone had occasion to be glad. Teeth gritted, her injured shoulder screaming at her, she heaved, swinging Stargirl through a 180-degree arc and then punching the cable release. As the jump line unwound from her ankle and the ground rushed sideways beneath her, Stargirl switched on her cosmic converter belt again. A split second later, she hit the ground, but not in a dead-on vertical fall. Instead, she plowed into the grass of Perez Island sideways, bounced, rolled, tumbled, and finally came to a halt in a heap at the base of the tower, her final impact cracking the concrete as her back smashed into the wall. A moment later, with a groan and a shake of her head, she pulled herself to her feet and dusted herself off. The belt was sputtering, its energy reserves almost exhausted, but the force field was still up and her wild ride had left her with no permanent injuries. In the momentary silence that followed, Batgirl reached up, plucked her descending cloak from the air, and whipped it back into its proper place. Above, Kara Zor-El stared in mute astonishment at the master monitor. Cyborg grinned. "Girl's got style to spare," he said. "I lose more bat jets that way," Batgirl muttered, observing the flaming crater. "Incoming!" Captain Cold yelled. Ursa dove out of the sky, bearing down on Batgirl. Heatwave blasted the diving Neo-Kryptonian full in the face with his highest possible heat output, not bothering to fire a stream of accelerant from his pistol. It wouldn't add enough energy to be worth bothering. At the same time, Cold jacked the output of both his freeze rays to maximum and fired at Ursa's center of mass. The twin thermal attacks were enough to distract her, if not actually harm her, and she missed Batgirl as the black-clad Titan dove out of the way. Ursa pulled out of her dive and wheeled, intending to strike out with her heat vision. But suddenly, Starfire was there, belting her once and again, her fists crackling with undischarged starbolts.
"You are a very unpleasant woman!"
Starfire yelled, punctuating each word with another blow.
"Ha ha ha!" Cyborg crowed, pumping a fist. "Now that's what I'm talking about! You can't stop Corey when she gets going. You can only hope to contain her, and there ain't enough of 'em for that."
New Krypton.
This is incredible," said Science Council Chairman Ral'uv, slumping in his chair. Around the table, the other counselors showed similar levels of shock.
The question nodded.
"You can have this data authenticated by your own security services if you like. I assure you, it's all quite genuine."
"No. No, the word of a lensman is good enough for the Science Council," Ral'uv said. "But it's just hard to believe. A coup? The murder of a Science Counselor and his wife, let alone the greatest Science Counselor in history? Nothing like this has happened among the Kryptonian people in 300 years.
"But why?" blurted Counselor Javro. If the question had possessed eyebrows, the counselor felt sure he would have arched one. "Why?" he asked. "Why what?"
"Why would General Zod do such things?" Javro sputtered. "He's had every advantage, been given every privilege. He swore he would mend his ways after we reprimanded him for his high-handedness 5 years ago.
The question folded his arms.
"Some men are good, some are not. A is A. Zod is Zod. Why? That I cannot say."
He put his hands in his coat pockets and shook his head.
"I am not the answer. I am only the question."
No one seemed to have a response to that, so the question inclined his head respectfully, said, "Good day, gentlemen," and left the chamber.
"What? Wait!"
Raluv cried, jumping up and running to the door. He burst out into the corridor, but the question was nowhere to be seen. Only a curling wisp of blue-gray smoke indicated that he had ever been there at all. New Avalon. While Starfire beleaguered Ursa, the other Titans kept their distance, nursed their injuries, and watched, until Robin noticed movement out of the corner of his eye, turned, and saw Nahn rising out of the still-burning wreckage of the Bat-Jet, his eyes glowing red. "Stargirl!" he snapped, pointing. "Got it," Stargirl replied. She dodged a blast from the mute renegade's heat vision and weighed her options. The brief downtime she'd been able to give the CCB had allowed it to cool, but hadn't done much for its energy reserves. She didn't have the power in hand to go toe-to-toe with a monster like Nahn. But she might not have to. Sending a mental command through the cybernetic circuitry embedded in her mask, she held up her hand and called the gravity rod to it. Nahn, thinking he knew what she was going to try, smiled cruelly and approached. Stargirl tried not to smirk as she aimed the rod at him and switched it on. The yellow-white beam lanced out and had no effect, just as before, but she kept it on him anyway, playing it over his barrel chest as he walked deliberately toward her. After a few moments, his steps started to come more slowly, and then more slowly still. His feet began sinking into the ground. A look of confusion crossed his ugly face as each step became a visible struggle even for a being of his incredible power. It never occurred to him that Stargirl wasn't trying to blast him as she had Ursa. She was using the gravity rod's other power, the one from which it derived its name. Normally, she used the rod's gravity-manipulating effect to negate gravity's effect so that she could fly, but the device could be reversed. With every step Nahn took toward her, the local gravity field affecting him doubled.
"Fall, you big bastard," Stargirl growled, holding the beam on him.
The bullet-shaped cap of the gravity rod was starting to emit a faint keening noise, its cooling rings glowing cherry red. Nahn was buried up to his waist in the ground now, and still he advanced. Taking one more dragging, rock-crushing step, he reached for her, his fingers straining for maximum reach. And then he crashed down on his face, sending rocks and chunks of sod flying in all directions. Stargirl kept the beam on him for several more seconds, driving him deeper and deeper into the ground, and then switched off the gravity rod at last. It went dark but for the pinging glow of its cooling rings. Nahn didn't offer to get up. Not one to waste an opportunity, Batgirl darted to the edge of the hole, tossed a transporter tag down onto the unconscious Zodite's back, and called it in. "Nice," she said to Stargirl once Nahn had vanished. "Thanks," Stargirl replied. She let the gravity rod hang from its lanyard and held her wrist with her free hand. The palm of her right glove was burned away, the skin beneath an angry red.
"Ow," Stargirl observed.
Batgirl said. She reached to her utility belt and got out a tube of burn spray. With her Tamaranian blood all but boiling with fury, Starfire had little trouble finishing off Ursa. By the time Batgirl had finished tending to her teammate's injury, the second Neo-Kryptonian was on her way to Special Detention E. The Titans regrouped wearily at the base of the tower. The only one of them not significantly injured or fatigued was Robin. Starfire and Stargirl had both burned off most of their energy reserves. Batgirl's shoulder was probably separated. The Flash, though it hardly moved during the fight, was worn down by the effort of drawing off the Zodite's speed. Of their unexpected allies, Heatwave was dangerously close to exhaustion, and Captain Cold's power cells were running low. Still, they'd done it. They'd defeated two highly trained Neo-Kryptonian fighters, and they'd done it with one of their own heavy hitters in reserve.
"Good work, team," Robin said.
"You too, guys," he added, nodding to Captain Cold and Heatwave. "Thanks for your help."
"Well, hey," Cold said with a cockeyed grin. "We figured Wally wasn't going to be any help, so we might as well give it a shot."
"Up yours, Cold," the Flash snorted. "Wasn't for me, you guys would still be walking here across an ice bridge. What kind of plan was that?"
"Quiet," Robin said, gesturing for the two to can their bickering.
"Chief, this is Robin. Any word on the location of..."
Then, looking up, he went ever so slightly pale, his voice trailing off. Never mind. General Zod himself was touching down not far from the smoldering wreckage of the Batjet, and he did not look at all pleased. Oh, crap, Cyborg spat. Then, turning to Kara, he said urgently, I gotta get down there and help. He pressed a key into her hand. Go down to the sub-basement and use the monitor in the mag-tube station. If he takes us out, get into the tunnel, head east as fast as you can, and find Raven on Gallery Island. She'll know what to do next. I hope, he didn't add out loud as he ran to the elevator. By the time he got to the ground, the fight, such as it was over. At the peak of their form, the Titans might have been able to take on even such a personage as General Zod, but with most of their energy spent in bringing down his subordinates, he dispensed with them easily. Cyborg emerged from the tower to find his teammates scattered all over the island, unmoving. You better hope they're just unconscious, he said through gritted teeth, his right arm transforming to cannon mode. Indeed, Zod said with a thin smile. You're hardly in a position to say anything about it. His heat vision slashed out, but Cyborg was ready for him. He raised his left arm, interposing a glowing blue photonic shield that splashed the scarlet rays harmlessly off to one side. Then he counterstruck, the blue-white beam of his photon cannon smashing into Zod's chest and sending the would-be dictator skidding back several yards. Zod mused. Upgrades. Then he abandoned any pretense of elegance. Not good, Griffin said. I'll go, Raven began, only to cut the words off abruptly as Griffin held up a hand. The reason he did so, though Raven couldn't know it directly, was that he was deep in an urgent conversation via lens. Lou, he called silently. I see it. I'm pulling in everything I can find, but... Griff, this is Adam, another voice cut in. I can be there in... No, Adam, Lou interrupted. He'll do the same to you if you engage him solo. Go to these coordinates and wait for Mary Marvel. She's inbound from Terminal Island, ETA 10 minutes. Kara will be dead in 10 minutes, Griffin objected. I know. If you've got any reserve capacity on your end, now's the time, boss. A third voice, high and urgent, sliced into the conversation. Chief! Cortana? I know how to stop Zod. I need your command access code to SphereCon. Where are you? How are you? Does it matter? The code! Now! The girl hasn't got the 678.8873 seconds it would take me to crack it. The exchange took perhaps a half second in the world outside Griffin's head. Then he rose from his seat, turned, and held out his hand to Raven. Come on, he said. I have to get back to headquarters now. She looked momentarily surprised, then nodded, took his hand, and began to chant. Kara watched on the monitor, next to the entrance to Titan's Tower's mag-tube tunnel, as Cyborg mounted a brilliant, furious, valiant, and utterly futile assault on General Zod. His capacities obviously surprised the general, but they were just as obviously no match for him. She knew he would lose, knew the time had come when all she could do was flee, and hope Griffin and Raven would have some way of stopping Zod's rampage. She knew Cyborg's arguments against her getting involved in the fight against Ursa and Non were even more true with Zod involved. He was one of the most skilled and powerful Kryptonian warriors in the galaxy, a man capable of laying low whole cells of Neo-Kryptonian outlaws under a yellow sun. She was a teenage girl with no combat training at all. She couldn't hope to stand against him. Her only option was to run away. But would her father have run away? Would her Uncle Jor? Would Kal-El have fled from a tyrant like Zod? For your information, Tin Man, Zod said conversationally as he held up the sparking wreckage of Cyborg by the plastron, I haven't killed your teammates. The way they handled Ursa and Non impressed me so much I decided to let them live. He narrowed his eyes, which began to glow. You, on the other hand, have annoyed me.
I think I'll slice open that cranium of yours and see if there's a real brain inside it.
Leave him alone, a sharp voice called. Zod blinked, the glow of readied heat vision fading from his eyes, and turned to see a tallish, slim blonde girl in her mid-teens standing at the base of Titan's Tower, dressed in a plain blue blouse and dressy dark pants. She looked utterly ordinary, utterly human, but even if they hadn't met before, he would have known who she was the instant he made contact with her eyes, eyes of a more intense blue than any human's could ever be. His interest in Cyborg vanished instantly. He discarded the disabled Titan with a negligent gesture and turned to face the girl.
Ah, Kara Zor-El. You've led me a merry chase, young lady. Have you come to surrender yourself to my lawful authority?
Kara glared at him with the sort of undiluted disdain only a teenager can manage with conviction. I've come to stop you, she said. And then, with a quick, angry gesture, she yanked open her blouse to reveal beneath it a snug-fitting blue T-shirt emblazoned with the scarlet and yellow sigil of the House of El. Zod went very still, his fists closing slowly.
Indeed, he said, his voice barely audible.